In this lecture, I'm going to try and motivate some of the assumptions that I made in previous lectures. Okay, so we just saw in the last two lectures how the story of the cosmological perturbations works. In fact, that is that the most natural setting is this two-scalar field case, and that this leads to very definite predictions regarding gravitational waves, non-Gaussianity, and so on. And in particular, predictions that are very different from simple inflationary models, for example. Now, I'm not going to talk about any perturbations here. I'm just going to try and give you a flavor of what all this looks like if you try and embed it into string theory. Or just in higher dimensional theories of gravity. So, in fact, the nice thing about this is that this gives you sort of a geometric picture for many of these quantities. And it not just makes it easier to visualize what's going on. This higher dimension point of view is not necessarily required for the model to work. So I'm just giving one, this is one motivation for this, but if the same kind of four-dimensional model arises in a different context, well, the cosmology will be the same. So a simple first step is to just look at, go one dimension up, try and see what this looks like in five dimensions, especially near the Big Crunch, because that's the crucial, that's really the crucial point. So we expect the higher dimensional point of view to be most relevant very close to the Big Bang, where the energies are high and where distance scales are small. So let's just look at this approach to the Big Crunch. And the five-dimensional Milne space-time turns out to be important in this. So after the end of the ekaperiodic phase, the potential becomes unimportant. Okay, so all we're left with is the kinetic energy of the scalar fields, and this is the kinetic phase. During this phase, the scale factor of the universe behaves as minus t to the power 1/3. Okay, so before that, we had the scale factor being very nearly constant, just contracting very slowly. Now it contracts a bit faster. All right, so why is what does this mean is sort of the question we're trying to answer. Now, if you just look at gravity in five dimensions, so the action is just the action, standard gravity, but in five dimensions. Because this is a five-dimensional metric, and this is the Ricci scalar that you make out of the five-dimensional metric. Now, assume that we are compactifying this theory. So assume this five-dimensional space-time is a four-dimensional space-time plus a circle. So we're compactifying a circle. That's one. But actually, with a slight twist, is that we're going to mod out by the group Z2. So we have a circle, and then we have, under the action of this Z2 symmetry, we identify points that are opposite on the circle with respect to this line through the middle. Okay, that's what the Z2 does. And so what we actually end up with is a line segment, since each of these points is equivalent to one of these, we can just consider half of this circle, and the end points are mapped into each other. So the end points here are fixed points. Fixed points. They're all also called orbifold fixed points. If you take a continuous manifold like this and you mod out by a discrete group, you call this an orbifold. That's just the name. So in fact, instead of this fancy language, you can just say we look at five-dimensional space-time being four dimensions plus one line segment. Now, then we write the metric, the five-dimensional metric, in terms of the four-dimensional metric. And then there's the fact that e to the minus square root of 2/3 phi plus the fifth dimension, which is parameterized by phi, e to the 2 square root of 2/3 phi dy squared. I'm calling this direction here y. Okay, so y now is a scalar field which determines the size of this line segment. The reason for including a factor of phi in front of the four-dimensional metric here is so that when you go from five to four dimensions, that the action you get has a canonically normalized scalar field. You can choose these numbers whichever way you want, but it turns out that this particular choice is the most convenient one. Because this means this turns into, when you plug this metric into the action here, or rather into the equations of motion, you get lower dimensional equations of motion, which you can then summarize again by an action. You find the four-dimensional action, which is just 1/2 times r minus d phi squared. Okay, so we have gravity in five dimensions turning into gravity plus a scalar field in four dimensions. And any solutions to the theory here in four dimensions would automatically be a solution to the theory in five dimensions if we plug that solution into this four-dimensional part of the metric here. So, in particular, we had the solution, well, the solution during the kinetic phase. So in the approach to the crunch, we can now find out, approaching the crunch in this way, within the theory which has only gravity and the scalar field, which is the kinetic phase, right? We can find out what does this look like in five dimensions. So we had the solution that ds4 squared is just equal to minus dt squared plus a squared dx squared, right? Where a squared now was proportional to minus t to the 1/3. If we put this in here, well, it's pretty, oh, sorry, I forgot to say something. During the kinetic phase, A gives us minus T to the 1/3, and phi, the scalar, is given by the square root of 2/3 log minus T, plus an integration constant. The integration constant is unimportant, just corresponds to a trivial rescaling of phi. What we find when we put this back, we get ds5 squared equal to, well, this e to the minus root 2/3 phi turns into a minus t to the minus 2/3. And then we have the four-dimensional metric, minus dt squared plus minus t to the plus 2/3 dx squared. Now, this is the four-dimensional piece we had before, plus e to the, sorry, minus t to the 4/3 dy squared. So what you can see from this immediately is that as t goes to 0, this fifth dimension shrinks. It goes as minus t to the power 4/3. So this fifth dimension shrinks away to 0. But what you can also see is that the coefficient in front of the spatial term, which is usually the scale factor, is actually a constant. This factor of minus t to the minus 2/3 cancels this factor of minus t to the plus 2/3. So what you thought in four dimension, you thought you had a big bang where the standard three spatial dimensions shrink to 0. Well, it turns out if you look at this from the five-dimensional point of view, these spatial dimensions are just constant at the big bang. They're not 0. what actually goes to zero is the fifth dimension, the extra dimension. Sorry?
I think that as three goes very fine without multiple. Story will be good without overflowing any assumption of the overflow.
So far, yes. I've included the overflow for later. So you can actually do, in order to see more clearly what's happening, is to do a new coordinate reparameterization, right? So that's called capital T, something proportional to minus T to the 2/3. Then actually, you can rewrite this metric as minus D capital T squared plus T squared dy squared plus dx squared. And this would only be valid, this metric, of course, would only be relevant very close to the Big Bang. Now, this piece here, the time and y-coordinate piece, is called Milne space-time. So it has sort of, and by doing another coordinate transformation, well, let me just say, here it's very clear now, the brain's, that is, well, not brain, the scale factors in 5D are finite, right, at the Big Bang. So you've traded a singularity in four-dimensional space to just one dimension shrinking away in five dimensions. And moreover, this space here is, you can do another coordinate transformation called little u t cosh y called little v capital T sinh y. Then actually, the S5 squared can simply be written as minus du squared plus dv squared plus dx squared. This is just Minkowski space. That means that the space-time that we're just looking at is locally completely flat. So all curvature invariants, for example, are zero, or approach zero. So as we go very close to the Big Crunch here, we're actually going to a space-time which is extremely flat, which is the surprising thing. This is because the ekparotic phase drives you into this solution. So this is the complete opposite from what you would intuitively expect to happen in a collapsing space-time. So in particular, you don't expect any higher derivative corrections to be important close to the Big Crunch. Of course, we have this T squared here. This is actually sort of see that this is some kind of conical space-time. So in fact, the space-time diagram would be, in terms of U and V, would be something like this, where anything here is the space-time. And as capital T goes to zero, we have this conical singularity here. So when I say all the curvature invariants go to zero, it means they go to zero, but actually at the crunch itself, there's a delta function singularity. But in the approach to it, there are no big curvatures. Then the crunch itself should properly be treated quantum mechanically. But if you have a universe that is very flat, up to extremely close to the Big Bang, then in some sense you've prepared it ideally so that it can make it through this this reversal from contraction to expansion. So now let's look at a more complete setup. The most complete setup we have so far are sort of all the various string theories in 10 and 11 dimensions. There's one version which is particularly relevant here. All these string theories are, but these dualities mean that all these different string theories are equivalent to each other. It just turned out that some are much easier to use for a given setup or for answering a given question than another one. In theory, you can just take a solution from any one of these and transform it into a solution of another one. But in some theories, the solution will look nice. In others, it will look extremely ugly. So there's one particular version, which is Ojala-Witten theory, which is most relevant here and which is nicest here to consider. So this is a relationship between 11-dimensional supergravity and the E8 cross E8 heterotic string. So what it is that you take 11-dimensional supergravity is the highest dimension supergravity theory you can have. The theories in lower dimensions are related to it by compactification, except for one or two special cases. Now, if you take this 11-dimensional supergravity on the manifold on the space-time, which is 10-dimensional, and then you take this orbifold, take this line segment, then what you have is you have this line segment, right? But at each point on this line segment, you have a 10-dimensional transverse space. But these endpoints are special. Right, so let me just draw the 10-dimensional space here at the endpoints. Because these are invariant under this Z2 operation. Here are these orbifold fixed points. In fact, these correspond sort of to the boundaries of space. You should picture that on the left and on the right of this, there is no... If you try to go to the right here, you end up again here on the left. But this is periodically identified. There is no space outside of this. So this would be the orbifold direction that I called y before. And it turns out that on each... If you want to make this a consistent theory, you have several anomalies, quantum anomalies you can calculate in this 11-dimensional setup. And it turns out that you can cancel all anomalies. You make this a completely consistent theory by putting E8 gauge theories on each of these. And so E8 is just a very large symmetry group. You don't need to know what it is. So in a sense, what you find here, the relationship between this and the heterotopic string theory is that when the string coupling constant happens to be related to the size of this orbifold direction. Okay, so we can write L11, if I call L11 the distance between the two brains, or let's call it D11. This is given by the string coupling constants G sub S to the 2/3. So if you have the string coupling constant being zero, you can think of these two boundaries, these two orbifolds sitting on top of each other, and that's the limit where you have an E8 cross E8 gauge theory. And then as soon as the coupling is non-zero, you have this interval in between them, and the two E8s separate. And that's sort of the relationship between the heterotic string and the 11-dimensional supergravity. And this is... The sense in which this is interesting for this setup is that now if you try to make a realistic particle physics theory out of this, you compactify an extra 6 dimensions on the Calabi-Yau manifold. Right? So you just go, what you do is you... This M10 plus S1 mod Z2 becomes an M4. This would be just R space-time times a Calabi-Yau manifold, which is 6-dimensional, times S1 mod Z2. So now you have this setup where you have the orbifold planes or brains at the end, and they're just 4-dimensional. The orbifold direction y is in between, and then at each point here, we have an extra Calabi-Yau space. What's interesting about this is that if you try to match this compactification to things like the Newton's gravity constant or things like this, what you find is that the size of this orbifold has to be bigger by a factor of about 30 or something like that than the size of the radius of the Calabi-Yau, if you assume that the Calabi-Yau is roughly isotropic. So this means that, and moreover, the Calabi-Yau size would be sort of at the Grand Unified scale or so. So if you probe the universe up, if you go up in energy in this theory, the universe looks four-dimensional first, because this orbifold direction will be very small. So it effectively looks four-dimensional. Then when you go higher up in energy, the universe suddenly starts looking five-dimensional first. And if you were to go all the way to the Planck scale, it would look 11-dimensional. But here we never go up to the Planck scale. We actually just, in all scales in the ekpyrotic theory, don't really go above the Grand Unified scale. So for all practical purposes, that means that close to the Big Bang, we can assume the universe to be five-dimensional. And then we know what the solution looks like. We've just calculated it, what it should look like very close to the Big Bang. So we had the solution we had before, except that now we have these two brains, right? And these two brains, therefore, at the Big Bang, so as t goes to zero, these brains collide. So the brain collision corresponds to the Big Bang. In fact, this gives us automatically a reason why we expect particle production. Because when these two brains collide, they don't collide exactly elastically. They will produce strings. So they will actually produce radiation and matter. Yes?
When we have a brain collision, then actually the brain gets extra energy and then go faster, the better the process is possible. But faster than, you know.
Right, so depending on how. I'm sorry?
In this case, the brain loses energy for particle production.
Well, no, not really, because this is a gravitational setup. You don't have the standard conservation of energy when gravity is included. What you have is, so one of these brains has positive tension, the other has negative tension. If you make matter on the negative tension brain, this is sort of lowering the inertia of that brain. It actually moves faster because it has negative tension. It's a slightly strange concept. But it's the only reason why this is actually stable, is that this negative tension brain is just at the boundary of space-time. So normally, if you have a negative tension object, if you try and perturb it, if you have a positive tension object and you perturb it a little bit, it wants to get back to where it was. Negative tension is just the opposite. You perturb it a bit and it wants to grow further. So typically, you expect a negative tension object to just explode. The only reason why this negative tension brain doesn't explode or doesn't blow up is that it is fixed by this Z2 symmetry. This symmetry fixes it at this boundary of space-time. So all the modes, the perturbation modes, which would cause it to grow and blow up, are mathematically forbidden. They just don't arise. So this is actually a stable situation. But you can't put a negative tension brain, for example, in the middle. If you put one in the middle, it will just blow up. The negative tension brain. You perturb it a little bit, it will go in all directions. It blows up. What I'm saying is it just wants to grow in all directions. It's very unstable. You don't want to be around. So in going from 11 dimensions to 5 dimensions, one can do a trick similar to the one which we had this before, which was to have, we have this, the volume of the Calabi-Yau manifold actually plays the role of this scalar that we called phi before. And the numbers here are slightly different. Minus 2/3 power plus 1/3, and then this is the metric on the Calabi-Yau space. So we would go from 11 to 5 with this metric, and then from 5 to 4 with the metric on the left there. And so, in fact, you can see immediately that this gives two scalar fields. Right? We get one, so in 4D, we got two scalar fields. The volume of the Calabi-Yau and the distance between the brains, so the radion. So you can immediately see that one would, in this setup, you would naturally expect gravity plus two scalar fields in four dimensions. So I'm good. Yes.
Not that I know of.
You can invent one if you like.
So the theory in five dimensions is called heterotic M theory. That this 11-dimensional picture is typically called M theory. And since this is the relationship to heterotic string theory, this is called heterotic M theory. So you have an action which is just gravity and the a kinetic term for the Calabi-Yau volume. It has a slightly funny look to it. One should actually take the logarithm of this to make it into a canonical term. And then it has one special feature is that it has a potential. And this comes from the compactification. It turns out in 11 dimension, you also have gauge fields. And if you have these brains there, they will cause the gauge field to be non-zero, and this causes this potential. Okay, so this is just a potential. What this potential means is that Minkowski space is not the solution to this theory. If you just set the Calabi-Yau volume to constant and you make the metric Minkowski space, then you don't get a solution. So this potential means that the vacuum of the theory will be something else, but actually it's very easy to guess what it is because it will just be this brain solution. So it's just, so the solution is this double domain wall solution. A domain wall is a brain which has one dimension less than the whole space-time. So here we have a five-dimensional space-time, but we have these four-dimensional boundaries, and those are also called domain walls. So I'm just going to write down the solution here. PS5 squared is given. It's all determined by this function little h, which is a function of y. So this is the metric is the following one. The Calabi-Yau volume is given by capital B times this little h to the 6/5. And little h is a function which is linear in y plus a constant c. So here, a, b, c are constants. And little h is a function which we have to, I said so before that, y is periodically identified because it comes from this circle that we had initially. So this is a linear function, but it's linear, and at the same time it has to be periodically identified, which introduces these kinks into it. Right, so this would be, say, minus 1, plus 1, and then I just call this here minus 1, plus 1. and then plus periodic identifications. And in fact, these kings, the locations of these kings, are exactly the locations of the domain walls. In the way I've drawn it here, it turns out if a king points downwards, this is a negative tension grain. And this one would be the positive one. But the whole space-time really is what's between minus 1 and plus 1 here. Now, this is just a static solution. You see, there's no time dependence. A, B, and C are just constants. However, we know that very close to the Big Bang, we expect the brains to move. There's no reason why they wouldn't move close to the Big Bang. There's lots of energy. You expect this just to be a dynamical setup. Now, if we want to, and moreover, we've just seen that this big crunch corresponds to the collision of the brains. So we want to be able to describe moving brains. The way to do this is to let A, B, and C to promote these two functions of time. Right? And this is valid if the brains are not moving too fast. This is a valid approximation. So such constants of integration in a solution are typically called moduli fields. And so we're just going to promote these, well, they're just moduli. And now we're going to promote them to moduli fields, so to functions of space-time. Oh, I'm sorry. Alpha is just related to this amount of flux you have coming from the higher dimension theory. It's a quantized number. it determines, in the end, it actually determines the tension of these brains, because it gives you the slope of this function, but the tension of the brains is determined by how much the slope changes. It turns out to be unimportant for what we have later on. I'm sorry?
Okay, alpha can be zero.
Alpha cannot be zero.
It cannot be
zero. It's forced to be non-zero. That's its main characteristic, actually. So now we promote, all right, so let's promote A, B, and C to functions of time. I'm not going to include spatial dependence here because this is very close to the Big Bang, that's less important. And in fact, the spatial dependence is then afterwards will be picked up by the perturbation calculations. This is, we're now looking at sort of the background evolution. And then, right, once these brains can move, you can imagine that there can be a force between these brains which draws them together. So this is just, because if you have a brain set up like this, the fundamental objects in this 11-dimensional theory are membranes. And you can have membranes which really sort of stretch between these two brains. And in the same way that you can, you know, write electrodynamics as sort of the virtual exchange of photons, you can have forces arising here by the virtual exchange of such membranes. And this will typically give you an attractive force between the brains. And this force between the brains then, in the four-dimensional context, is the ekpyrotic potential. It's very difficult to do these calculations in detail, and there aren't really any specific examples around. This is just what you would generally expect to get. What you get in detail depends on the specific model, the specific collabial you choose, the specific. There's lots of other ingredients that go into this in order to get the right particle physics model. And so you would have to know all this in order to calculate the potential properly. So still nobody knows how to do that exactly. But conceptually, this is where the potential comes from in this framework. Yes.
Basically, there's also a question to me. So we have some sub capital sub to for the five fish, right?
And yes.
Two fish forms.
Yes.
So the brain has two faces. Right? This face is right.
No, these brains. So this is periodically identified. If you go, if you try to go to the right here, you end up on the left here. These are sort of one-faced brains.
Okay. So
the only the physical space-time is really just what's in between the brains.
So that kind of thing that will.
Oh, sorry. I shouldn't. Actually, I made a mistake. If you try to go to the right, you end up going back to the left.
Yeah.
This is periodically identified in the sense that you have two identifications. One is this, two reflections plus the circle. You can picture this as having, you know, another brain here, another brain here. This brain corresponds to this one, all right, and that one corresponds to that one. Plus, you have a reflection symmetry of the whole thing around this axis, for example. So if you try to go further here, this again corresponds to being here. This corresponds to being here. This corresponds to being here.
So this kind of already maybe forces cancels.
Only if you have a supersymmetric configuration. And the supersymmetric configurations, that corresponds to where the brains are fixed. In a cosmological constant context, you know that supersymmetry is automatically broken. So there will be forces between the brains. Right, so if you just make A, B, and C functions of time, you can then plug these functions back into the original, the five-dimensional action which I have up there. And then this would give you an action for these fields A, B, and C. What you get is typically, well, not typically, what you get in a specific case is very complicated. But it turns out there is a very nice change of coordinates that you can do, field redefinition you can do, which brings this into a nice form. So there's no point for me to write down the action you get directly in terms of A, B, and C. If you're interested, there, I can give you a reference where you can look it up. But it's the important thing is that there's is this field redefinition. Okay, so call, I'm just going to define this IN, which is integral of this function h to the power n going from minus 1 to plus 1. Okay, and then you just do this the following field redefinition, a squared being capital A squared b I to the 3/5. Actually, you can definitely verify this calculation if you want. It's just, it will take you a bit of time. But you can certainly, if you're interested, certainly then you should do it. Phi 1 here is given in terms of e to the phi 1 of root 2 is given by b I to the I sub 3/5 to the power 3/4. I mean, from the fact that this is not a very obvious field redefinition, you can guess that the original action was very ugly. And phi 2 is minus root 6 over 20 times the integral over c, 1 over I, 3/5. If you're only interested in the end result, you don't even have to write this down. Plus 16 I minus 7/5 I plus 2/5. And the square root of this whole thing. Right. So this is, and this miraculously gives you the four-dimensional action, which is the integral of minus 6 a prime squared plus a squared phi 1 prime squared plus phi 2 prime squared. Right. This is just the standard action for gravity and two scalar fields, where A is the scale factor. And everything is canonically normalized. So this whole complicated setup reduces to this very simple action. And that's the action we used in the last lecture to calculate cosmological perturbations. So this is where it comes from. Well, this is one possibility for where it could come from. In fact, you can see that A has to be the scale factor by just looking at it. A goes like capital A, and capital A in the metric up here takes the place of the scale factor. But what this means now is that we can relate all quantities in this four-dimensional theory to what they mean in terms of brains and so on. So, for example, you can express the volume of the Calabi-Yau, the distance between the brains, the scale factors on the brains, all in terms of these fields, phi 1 and phi 2. So, for example, at y equals minus 1, again, these are relations that are you can find in the literature if you like, but the important point here is that for example, the volume of the Calabi-Yau at the location of the negative tension brain is given by this expression here. Now, here you can see immediately that phi 2 has to be a negative number for this to make sense, right? Because this is to the power 3/2. So it turns out that phi 2 equals 0 corresponds to the Calabi-Yau volume at the location of the negative tension brain being 0. And phi 2 negative, phi 2 positive is actually unphysical. And that means that really, if you look at this space, scalar field space, positive values of phi 2 are actually ruled out. At the same time, there's relationships like this for the scale factors, and they will show you, give you the same result as what we had for the Milne solution before, which is that as you go to the crunch, the scale factors go to finite values. So it's easy to solve this theory. If there is no potential, it's easy to solve it. And by the way, this is called the moduli space approximation. To take these moduli fields, promote them to functions of time, then work out the effective action for this. This is the moduli space approximation. If the brains move very fast, this is not valid anymore, because then this background solution around which we're perturbing would have to be changed. So the solution to the action, to the moduli space action, has to be picked. As we saw earlier, the ekpyrotic phase makes the universe very flat, and it drives the universe to this Milne phase. So if we pick a solution, we have to pick one which corresponds to getting Milne in five dimensions. And it's given by A equals to 2 tau to the 1/2, e to the phi 1 is given by 2 tau to the 3/2 root 2, and e to the phi 2 turns out to be given by 4 alpha tau root 3/2 root 2. Okay. And in this, you can check that by going back through these via these definitions, if you go back to the quantities in five dimensions, you can check that in this solution, the scale factors in five dimensions actually go to constants as tau goes to 0. So also the distance between the brains goes roughly as 2 tau for this solution, and that's, so you can see again that tau equals 0 corresponds to the brain collision. So if you allow, if you have this solution and you try and look at what it looks like in this scalar field space, it actually corresponds to straight line, and then which just reflects off this boundary. Tau equals 0 would be down here at minus infinity. This is some particular value, doesn't matter what it is. And however, this is, of course, this is a problem because, the, as I just said, this corresponds to the volume of the Calabi-Yau space going to 0 close to one of the brains. If this goes to 0, that means we really have a singularity and we shouldn't trust this moduli space approximation. However, it turns out that this is only true if the brains are completely empty. As soon as you add matter onto the brains, and we know that matter will be on the brains, it turns out that that gives rise to sort of an effective repulsive potential away from this boundary, so that what you really get is a trajectory that bends around without touching, without going all the way to the singularity. So roughly speaking, so at, so if you have matter on negative, on the negative tension brain, actually, I should, to be precise, I should say for a wide variety of matter, there are matter particular matter choices for which this, which actually accelerate the way, which actually cause the spacetime to go more singular. But those are quite special. The standard choices of matter that you would think of to consider actually cause this behavior here, that you reflect, that you're pushed away from the singularity. So on this negative tension brain, the Einstein equations leads to, let me call the scale factor on the negative tension brain A minus. The, roughly speaking, you get an equation which is something like A double dot going as the matter stress tensor, the trace of the matter stress tensor. On the positive tension brain, it would be the opposite sign. You'd have a minus sign here. And any kind of matter would cause the scale factor to shrink. Here, it turns out, because you have this negative tension, you get a plus sign here, and for just about all types of matter, well, plus, if these matter types couple to the Calabi-Yau volume, you will get corrections to this. Let's say V Calabi-Yau dependent corrections. So you can look at this in more detail, but the result is basically the same, is that, which is that, this is typically positive. And so you actually, what you find is that, strangely enough, you have the scale factor bounces back. So you have this matter on the negative tension brain causes it to repel back. This is something that ordinary gravity doesn't allow you to do. Ordinary gravity implies that if you have a collapsing universe, it will collapse all the way. But here, the negative tension causes the negative tension brain to bounds. Okay, and so actually the trajectory you end up having in this scalar field space is a trajectory which gets smoothly reflected off. And this is exactly the background evolution we used to calculate cosmological perturbations. So now also what this means is that if you take this higher dimensional point of view to interpret these perturbations. So these perturbations actually correspond to little ripples in the brains. So that means that when the brains collide, they don't collide everywhere at exactly the same time. You can imagine that certain points, you have little ripples in the brain, so certain points on the brains collide a little bit earlier. So in some sense, the Big Bang starts a bit earlier there. It has more time to cool, and this will give colder regions. Whereas in other places, the brains collide a little bit later, so the Big Bang starts a bit later, it's still a bit hotter, and those give the hotspots that you get in the cosmic microwave background. So these ripples on the brains translate into the temperature perturbations in the CMB in this picture. Okay, so that's really the picture you get from string theory. During the last lecture, we'll actually look in much more detail at the sort of the whole cyclic behavior. As I said earlier, this potential, this ekpyrotic potential for two scalar fields is unstable. This leads to very special properties if you want to make a cyclic universe out of this. And in fact, we'll just generally look at sort of the constraints and things, information you get from trying to make a cyclic universe. Okay, but that's for next time. Thanks.